We have with us today Tracy Twyman and Andy Colvin. We're going to talk about a couple of things, but I would think foremost might be the economic situation in the United States, if there really is one, but I've said enough about that. I'm going to let Andy do the intro, and take it away, Andy.
We have with us Tracy Twyman. Tracy's been writing about alternative history and the occult for 14 years. She's the author of several nonfiction books and is also the former editor of Dagobert's Revenge, a journal of esoteric history that was published from 1996 to 2003. In 2006, her website made national news when it was banned by the Supreme Court of Pakistan on charges of blasphemy. Recently, she was featured in the documentary film Bloodline, released in May 2008. Her book, The Merovingian Mythos, was licensed by Sony for use in the upcoming film Angels and Demons, which has already come out, right?
Yes.
Yeah, the prequel to The Da Vinci Code. That's the older bio from Coast to Coast. So thanks for having or being on, Tracy.
Thanks so much for having me on, guys. It's going to be interesting, I'm sure. Thanks.
That's another word for it, that's for sure, yeah. So we had talked, if you don't mind, Tracy, before we got on. We usually do something that's topical because we cover some events in the month, and there's always a kind of thread that runs through them. But there's one that's obviously right in the middle of everything. And it's been there for a while, and right now we're dealing with some kind of brinksmanship. And that is the economic situation. And I'll just say this, and I don't think it's so far-fetched, but I'm to the point now with all the economic systems you hear about and all this blah, blah, blah about Keynesian economics and all this. I'm to the point now where I think the bankers, who are probably the most powerful people in the world, I'm just wondering if there really isn't anything out there anymore, and we're just simply going because they allow us to. And are we heading for some kind of catastrophe out of which they will probably birth a new economic order, a new monetary system? And whether or not this is the goal that the Knights Templars had in mind, or this is something that went horribly awry, I'm going to throw it to you, Tracy. You've been involved in this. Where are we now? Where are we going? And how did this all begin?
Okay, well, yeah, I wrote about this topic from a esoteric perspective, really, in two of my books, Solomon's Treasure, which came out in 2005, and then the most recent, Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge. In both of these books, I wrote about the connections between the monetary system, the global monetary system, of which the U.S. dollar has been so far in the last, I would say, 80 years or so, has been the, you know, the keystone, has been the central, well, they call it the reserve currency. And all of these other countries throughout the world, for, you know, quite a number of them, over 100 of them, are using the U.S. dollar as their reserve currency. I've been comparing this in my books to alchemy, to magic.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not just making a metaphor. I mean, I literally mean that. And one of the things I've done is I've gone actually through the entire history of money, going from the beginning in ancient Sumeria and all the way to modern times, showing how money was invented for spiritual purposes, really, having to do with sacred prostitution rites in the Temple of Ishtar. And then throughout history, it's associated with temples and priesthoods, and it really represents... in a way, it represents the aristocracy's ownership of the rest of the other people, and it represents a system of slavery, but specifically mm-hmm. spiritual slavery. It represents your, as an individual subject, your slavery to the state, and you know, I'm talking about in ancient times here, the ancient roots of it, and then it. Furthermore, the other level to that is that the state itself is composed of, an aristocracy of, in ancient times, it would have been a royal family, a monarchy, and then a priesthood. And they themselves are, you know, the slaves of something else, they say. You know, some sort of gods or something from outside this universe, right? All of the... bloodlines, the royal bloodlines of the ancient world, they would always say that they were actually the descendants of these gods. And so the what I'm getting at here is that money really represents and was instituted as a way of collecting sacrifices from the public. There's this rite of the sacrifice of the firstborn that is like really the most central rite in all religious history. You know, all religion really, in my opinion, boils down to this one concept of sacrifice. And the earliest concept really is the sacrifice of the king's firstborn son. But what happened throughout history is societies kept finding ways of substituting this sacrifice so that the king wouldn't actually have to sacrifice his firstborn son.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead, that duty got passed on to the public, basically. And this is a long-winded way of saying that yes, taxes and the monetary system itself, in my opinion, represents this concept. It is this system of slavery and sacrifice, where we have to give of ourselves, you know, give our time, our blood, sweat, and tears, our labor, and our future, and our children's future, and ultimately our property. We sacrifice a portion of this to the state or to the to the church, and it's this weird mystical ritual, in my opinion.
Well,
and what's going on now is really the end result of what inevitably will happen when you set up a situation like that.
Tracy,
sorry. Go ahead.
I'm sorry. I didn't mean to step on you.
No, please. I need some help here.
No. Because you don't know really where we're at. But, I mean, the biblical account would have it that there would have been no money. There would have been no need for money. We're talking about coin, right? I mean, the actual thing. If we can just take that for a second. But because the tribes didn't want to live under divine law and that they didn't want to necessarily deal with judges and priests, they went into another world that would be necessarily constructed by Satan. Now, that we all deal with money doesn't make us Satanists or anything like that. It's a system. It's understood. But in that void, as far as I can see in Scripture, it says that basically Satan set up a mercantile system. And that is what is at the root of everything, because actually banking probably could work correctly. And if it did, it would be fine, but it isn't. It was never done like that. I mean, you go back as far as you said, like either in Sumeria or Babylon. I mean, here you got a coin that's pressed out. Let's say it weighs an ounce, and let's say it's worth $10. So what do the bankers do? They thinned it out more, made it a half an ounce, and still had a $10. Boom, there's their money. In a way of monetary alchemy, in a sense, they actually, and of course, fractional reserve banking, which we have in the United States and probably everywhere now, you actually make something out of nothing. So, I mean, I don't know if that's a concept that is considered alchemical, but did you touch upon that? I mean, are you okay with the fact that they basically make money out of thin air?
That is what I'm talking about. That's the alchemical metaphor. There's an association historically with, like I was saying, religion and money and ritual and gold, being associated with the sun, silver being associated with the moon. So there was that association already there. But then the age of alchemy really came about during the Middle Ages, and then afterwards, in the Renaissance, a lot of more ancient alchemical texts were from Greece, really, were sort of discovered and reinterpreted. And so that's when the concept of money was also revolutionized, mm-hmm. really, and the Knights Templar did have something to do with that. They invented a system of checking, and really it had to do with their role as bodyguards for pilgrims on the road to the Holy Land. They were supposed to protect them from highway robbery. That was part of their raison d'etre. That was part of the reason why they were created,
right,
in the first place. So they actually created the system that was supposed to, it was going to help people with that, because, you know, it was quite dangerous to go from Western Europe to the Holy Land with gold and silver in your pocket. You would get robbed. So they created the system where you could create a bank account, essentially, mm-hmm. at your first stop on the pilgrimage, and you would go through this route where every night you would stop at one of the Templars' preceptories, and there you would, you know, be treated with hospitality. You would get to stay there and eat meals there, and you could charge it all on your account that you had started at the very first preceptory. And every stop you went along the route, you would present them with this chit, which right. was a coded parchment that had all of the information about your account. And that really was the birth of the checking system. And, you know, modern banking really harkens back to that. And we even see traces of this. And you mentioned the Freemasons. Of course, the Freemasons really, you know, modeled themselves after the Knights Templar in some ways. And a lot of the families that started the first Masonic lodges also can be traced back to the Knights Templar. So there is a line of continuity there. And, of mm-hmm. course, then the Freemasons were hugely influential in the creation of the British banking system, where they really perfected this concept of what you're calling fractional reserve lending. And several people, I'm sure, have heard the concept described before in terms of gold in strong boxes. And it's a simple metaphor. Well, it's not even a metaphor. It's a simple description of what was happening in the beginnings of this fiat currency banking system, and it explains exactly what's going on. You had at that time goldsmiths that were also making their living as holders of other people's gold. They had vaults where people could bring their gold to, you know, sit there for safekeeping. And some of these goldsmiths did sort of take the ideas that the Knights Templar had developed and take them a little bit further. And they thought, you know, well, if people can put faith in a piece of paper, a coded piece of paper that says how much money they have on account, you can actually trade the piece of paper instead of the gold, and you know, the gold can just sit in the vault, and we can do business with these pieces of paper. And what that created was an excellent cover for, I don't know, for financial funny business, I guess you would call it. They figured out that basically only a fraction of people would ever actually come in and check on their gold that they had on account, and most people would just do business with the checks, basically. And so they decided that, you know, we could just loan out most of this money to other people and make more money. And, you know, as long as we have some money on hand for when people need to withdraw from their account, everything will be fine. As long as not everyone comes in and withdraws from their account at the same time, you know, you can keep this essentially a Ponzi scheme going forever, you know. And, of course, you can never keep it going on forever, and that's what the history of banking is, the history of panics and busts where mm-hmm. people, you know, get nervous that there's not enough money in the bank to cover their accounts anymore, and they all run on the bank, and then it busts, and then everyone's screwed. No one gets their money. And so, you know, earlier in the 20th century, they created a way, allegedly, to prevent that from ever happening again. And, well, it had some other disastrous consequences. But I've been talking a long time, so I feel the need to let you break in here.
Well, then, let me go back to this. The thing is, the Knights Templar, which I think actually were born out of a vow of poverty, got themselves involved in this. But you're saying that the Knights obviously didn't play it straight.
Well, I don't know that they didn't play it straight. I don't know. But okay. I think it's quite possible that they were doing what we're describing as far as fractional reserve lending themselves. I don't know that. That's never been really proven. But okay. Shortly after the Knights Templar were dissolved, that's when this this system that we're describing of fractional reserve lending, where you only keep a portion of the gold on hand and loan the rest out, that all sort of developed around the same time that the Knights mm-hmm. Templar were being suppressed, disbanded, tortured by the church at that time. But I think what happened the end of the Knights Templar, why they were persecuted, sort of could very well tie into this. And what I mean by that is that they were accused of worshiping the devil because people couldn't figure out why they were getting rich so quickly. And another thing is that the crown heads of Europe owed them all a lot of money, and they were nervous that, you know, this, there was this organization that it was transnational. They actually had a charter from the Pope that they didn't have to, pay homage to any of the kings of the lands that they occupied. You know, they basically, their preceptories were like a tax haven. You know, it was a, mm-hmm. it was something. Right. It was a separate political entity from the land around them. So they weren't beholden to these kings. They were loaning them money, but they didn't need to follow their rules at all. Their only boss was the Pope, and so that's why the crown heads of Europe really conspired against them, and specifically this one king of France, Philip, conspired, finally got the Pope on his side and said, you know, we got to get rid of these people because they're far too powerful. And people actually thought there was something quite suspicious about how much money and power they had, and they actually thought that they had gotten it by worshiping the devil. And these ideas were sort of strengthened by the fact that people who had been Knights Templar and defected were telling stories about rituals they were doing where they were invoking this demon called Baphomet. And they said that Baphomet was really the one that made the Templars rich and caused their fields to be fruitful. And everything good that was happening to the Templars supposedly was coming from their worship of this demon, Baphomet. And so when they arrested them and started torturing these knights, accusing them of this, you know, quite a lot of them did confess, and the confessions were, you know, quite detailed and very similar. So it's interesting that, yeah, they did seem to be going through these bizarre metaphysical rituals where they attributed their financial success to this demon. But in reality, it seems to me that, you know, their financial success probably had a lot to do with this banking system that they invented. And if they were doing fractional reserve lending at a time when no one else had ever thought of doing that, mm-hmm. then, yeah, it would seem like they were just making money out of nothing magically and that the devil might have something to do with it. So I really think that the idea of worshiping Baphomet and the idea of the alchemy of fractional reserve lending became fused at that time, and whether they were actually ever the same thing or not, I'm not sure. But, that sort of the tradition, the two traditions, I think, went hand in hand, and then I think that connection was probably, you know, continued mm-hmm. through the traditions of Freemasonry. And then, you know, when you go to the City of London, in London there's this section, the Financial yep. District of London, that, again, is this separate political entity from the land around it. You know, they like to do this.
Yep.
They like to create their own special space. And in the City of London, you'll find all of these old Templar domains, really, where the foundation of the building is still the same. That was the same one that was built for the Templars ages ago. And these are the buildings where the lawyers do their business. Temple Bar is where the lawyers get, you know, past the bar.
Right.
The bar exam in England, and they're, you know, they're doing it right there on Templar land. So in my mind, I think that sort of the political and economic institutions of England, and then, of course, that tradition was carried on over here, I think it really, you know, can be very directly connected to the Knights Templar and to their bizarre rites of Baphomet. And, and I was saying, you know, that this is alchemy and that it's not a metaphor, it really is alchemy. What I mean by that is that from that time onward, from the Middle Ages onward, the history of money and the history of alchemy are completely intertwined. And I have several instances of this in my books where I show that, you know, major changes in the way that money is created, the way it functions, are usually being spearheaded by someone who's very deeply involved in alchemy. And I talked about Isaac Newton, who was a comptroller of the currency in England, and His alchemical papers were later purchased from a Sotheby's auction by John Maynard Keynes.
Mm-hmm.
And even the first dollars, the first silver dollars, were created in Bohemia. And they were minted by someone who was an alchemist. And he said that when he finally started minting dollars, that's when he discovered the key to alchemy. So, and even the dollar sign, of course, is an alchemical symbol. It's basically the caduceus, which is the symbol of alchemical transformation, the magical wand that that Hermes holds, and Hermes is the god of alchemy. So, I mean, there's really no separating alchemy from modern economics.
Tracy, let's do a little business, and then I'm going to throw it to Andy if he has any questions. I have a ton, but at any rate, if people want to check out your books and find out a little bit about them and be able to order, where would you send them?
Well, they should go to TracyRTwyman.com. That's TracyRTwyman.com. And that'll take you to all of my different websites and stuff where you can find my books. You can download free podcasts and lots of free articles and stuff. And, of course, if you missed that or if it's hard to spell, you can pretty much spell my name, Tracy Twyman, how you think it's spelled, and Google will figure it out for you.
That's
and correct
right.
you.
Okay.
So, you know, it's easy to find me. And I'm on all my stuff's on Amazon, too.
Okay. Andy, as I said, you know, I've been into this thing, and I've got some more questions. But at this point, if you got something to ask of Tracy, by all means, do so.
Why don't you go ahead, Viz? Right. I'll just say that you are listening to That Was the Month That Wasn't, where we ask the question, where are you at on what the hell is going on?
I know. And I don't want to jump ahead too quickly, and yet, on the other hand, we might have to make some progress here. But can we say that banking went, I would say, took a really bad turn when you started to not have the money but make something that was representative of the money? You mentioned the chit. You can call it the beginning of checking. You can call it the beginning of the credit card. The money was deposited with the Knights. They offered this representative element, this thing, and people had that. It wasn't money. It was something that represented money. Now, we're doing the same thing today. I mean, even those green things in our wallet is really representing, supposedly, money, but it's not the thing. Going back to, shall we say, the bastardization or the corruption of the whole money situation, do you see that as a defining moment when you made something that represented what was of true value?
Well, yeah, that's certainly what opens the field to all sorts of, you know, I guess, wrongdoing. I mean, misrepresentation, you know, and that's what's made us so vulnerable. I mean, you know, like we were describing, the fractional reserve lending only works at all if, for one thing, everyone has faith in the system. Not everyone goes and takes their money out all at once, and there's enough money in there, there's enough of a reserve to keep that balance going. And it really historically has always come down to a 10-to-1 ratio. That's the norm. For whatever reason, I think it probably has to do with human psychology, but
yeah.
1 out of 10 people will go and withdraw their money or check on their money at any one time. And one of the points I made in Solomon's Treasure, as I talked about the tithing principle in ancient Israel and actually several other cultures as well, how it seems like it's so common that you're supposed to sacrifice or give a tax of 10% to the state or to the church. And there's this idea that God will reward you tenfold for whatever you give in his name.
Oh,
I think that's sort of an alchemical concept itself, you know. But the problem nowadays, bringing it back to like modern times and current events, is that that ratio has just been completely blown. And basically, mm-hmm. what's been happening over the last few years is the Federal Reserve is giving out money at 0% interest. In other words, there's really zero reserves for all of this money that's being pumped out there. And so right now, you know, we've all heard about the derivatives bubble that, burst in 2008. And a lot of people don't really understand it. And I'm not going to say I can explain it very well, but I'll tell you that what it comes down to is that there's about $700 trillion worth of assets floating around, or excuse me, worth of debt floating around, and about $30 trillion worth of actual assets. So we've got, you know, way more paper than stuff on Earth. And that's if you actually took everything from every human being, enslaved every human being, took the gold out of their teeth and everything, you still wouldn't be able to pay back the banks what they think they need to be paid. And the, you know, the problem is that, yeah, there's nothing you can do about it at this point. It's so screwed. You know, they talk about austerity and how we need to tighten our belt. We need to balance the budget. You know, we need to raise the debt ceiling. None of that stuff is going to work. Mathematically, it's just completely screwed. So, you know, I mean, would you agree? I mean, how can you conceive of fixing that? And of course, it only is going to get worse because, you know, the whole system is built on compound interest. So, the more you're in debt, the more you're going to be in debt. You know, it's just going to snowball exponentially more and more. But so I think it's over at this point, you know?
I do too. And of course, we haven't talked about this, but I come from, I don't even know if I come from in a different direction, but I'm looking at this and I understand, and it's, you know, economics is great and macro and micro and all this, and I don't mean to necessarily just dismiss it, but there comes a time when common sense, I think, has to reign, and everyone has a pretty good idea analytically that something is not quite right. Now, you mentioned slavery before as a produce of banking. And now here we are in the United States, and we think we're free, and blah, blah, blah. Yeah, I get that. And yet we are in a system that has made us all slaves. But now we've come to a point in the system, and this is what I'm going to throw out to you, where something has taken a very nasty, malevolent turn. And I think we're seeing that we're just in the beginning of it. And let me run something by you, and this is accurate information. With some other people, some other researchers who have been writing articles, along with myself, we came upon the fact that two things are going on that have never gone on before. That one, every nation is a debtor nation. Every nation. And two, they're all on fiat currency. And as Anthony C. Sutton wrote about a long time ago, if you can deal with a fiat system, then you can swing things wildly and you can have panics and whatever you want to do, you can manipulate it. It's a roller coaster ride in a fiat world. Now, let me ask you, what if you've taken this as being true, just if you've not heard it, and you can accept that, are we in a situation now, and we look at Greece, they pop Greece out every so often, it almost seems like a rite of spring, you know, oh, they're riding in Greece, and then Italy's not doing well, and Ireland's in trouble, and Spain's in trouble, and we're in trouble. Are we looking at something where the system might be actually turning on all the peoples of the world?
Well, it is. It's like a million times worse than what happened in the 30s and then, you know, kind of got finalized at the end of World War II with the institution of the Bretton Woods international finance system. Mm-hmm. What all was going on there, in 1933, the United States basically became bankrupt, declared bankruptcy to its international creditors, and that's when all of the property, literally all the land, became hypothecated to the creditors. In other words, they own it.
Right.
You know, we have real estate, we have the right to basically rent it, but the banks own the land, and they also own us to a certain extent.
Yep.
That's why I call it slavery, because they, you know, we have the income tax. And that basically means, you know, they own your labor. They own the fruit of what you do. So that was already on the books. You know, it's kind of shocking to realize, but yeah, the government acts like it owns you and it sells you on the open market to other governments and other corporations. And then, you know, now we're at the point where we're in debt again. That bought us a little bit more credit. That got us financed for another, you know, 60, 80 years or so. And here we are again now, and we need to somehow refinance this. And it's not just us, but everyone. It's the whole system, and it's largely to do with the fact that the United States was providing the reserve currency up until recently, and, you know, no one wants to do that anymore. No one wants the U.S. dollar to be, you know, in the reserves of their central banks. It's like a bomb, you know, it's like a hot potato. You don't want it because it's so worthless. So, you know, at this point, the problem we've got is, of course, we're allowing the government to, you know, speak for us still. People are still completely unaware this is even happening and what it really means. You know, they're not aware that the U.S. government right now is bargaining, you know, how to refinance this with the international bankers. And so what it comes down in my mind, it comes down to what can they possibly, they being the government, possibly offer the international banking cartel to get another round of financing or to get the whole system reset or something. You know, you've got to offer something to satisfy them. And they've already got our property. They've already got us enslaved. So what the heck else can they possibly do? And I really think, this is going to sound weird, but I really think that the next step, the final frontier, is your physical body. Because up until now, that has been, you know, there's been some level of sanctity to that. And right now there's rules about that you're not allowed to sell your own body parts on the open market, right? Well,
guess
that's
what?
All going to change, I think. Not that you still won't be able to sell your body parts, but you may be forced to donate your body parts, and then those will be sold. Or, you know, your body will be financed and it will become a source of derivatives. It will become a source of bonds and debt. And I literally think that's the next stage because, you know, there are all these life-extending technologies now, but they can't possibly make them available to everyone. In fact, they're making it pretty obvious that they want to restrict access to health care. And I think what they really want in the future, you know, is they want to be able to just have an endless supply of body parts so that they can live forever. And they've got, you know, an overabundance of labor supply. They don't need as many slaves as they have. So, you know, that's really where I think this is going.
Well, that would tie in with the agenda for depopulation. It makes perfect sense. And I read a couple of books in the earlier part of this first decade, where they were kicking this around. Of course, it's all theoretical until it finally happens. But they were—I mean, I read a book actually where the authors had created, and this is on behest of the UN, which is no surprise. They made an indices of production to consumption. In other words, if your family unit consumed more than it produced, there at the very least would be a heavy fine for that. At the worst, you could take a look at being considered a useless feeder and eliminated. And I think this goes along with what you're talking about. This is, slavery to the nth. And when you said they're coming for your body, beyond even the body parts, they're taking a look at every one of us as, well, let's face it, let's call it what it is, chattel. I mean, even when you look at what used to be called, the personnel department, now it's called human resources.
Yeah.
And it just gets more and more, you know, sterile and quantitative, not qualitative. And so, definitely. I mean, you see children now that are coming out of the womb with a Social Security number. And that's their labor pledged against them for the rest of their lives. And if they're not going to be productive human beings, then do we really need these people around? Now, this sounds all very crazy. Although Huxley touched upon this, and Orwell to a certain extent. And I don't think they were wrong. I think they were, if not prophetic, they knew exactly where this was headed. Now, I said a lot there also, but I mean, given the fact that this is slavery brought to everything that could possibly happen, a complete quantitative analysis of everyone's lives, does that seem so strange to you as far as where we're going with a banking world and the world in general?
No, I mean, I think we've been chattel for a while, you know, and that's why I think we're going to the next step where they're not even going to bother to, you know, pretend that we have the right to life. That, you know, I think we're at this point food, literally a food source, you know.
Get
to that point. And that's one of the metaphors I deal with, especially in my most recent book about money. In Money Grows on the Tree of Knowledge, I talk about how there are all of these metaphors in the alchemical texts about the process of alchemy having to do with the creation of a homunculus, of a little baby, or taking a little baby and killing it and draining the blood and boiling it in an Athanor and processing all that stuff until you turn it into gold magically. And then there's stuff, there's other metaphors that are a bit complex, but really, I think I made a very good case that alchemy, the ritual of alchemy, is about taking children and turning them into gold. And the comparisons I made with the modern economy, I think, are spot on again, that, yeah, at this point, what is financing these derivatives? What are they based on? Well, they're not even based on our labor anymore, because that has been sold and used already,
right.
And it's gone. So what's paying, you know, if you're getting Social Security right now or Medicare or anything like that, you know, what's paying for that? People like to think it's their taxes. No, it's your, it's money taken off on the future of your children's future earnings. You know, basically you have sold your children into slavery already, and they may never even exist, but the concept of your children has been sold. So, you know, that's, I think that at this point, yeah, not only have we been treated as slaves this entire time, but it's going to a level that we've never actually experienced before, where, yeah, this is what it's like to be, you know, a cow, and they decide whether it's worth it more to milk you or to slaughter you and make you into a steak.
What do you make about what's going on right at this time, though? If you accept what I've stated as true, and I believe it to be such, are we looking at, you know, people expect something in 2012 to be either geological or perhaps astronomical, some kind of devastation in that order. But could it possibly be that in 2012 we'll find some kind of never-before event, and where you wake up one morning, it's like, guess what, we're all bankrupt. The whole world's in Chapter 13. We have to realign. What's the possibility of that?
Interestingly, one of the anniversaries that will occur on that date, on December 23rd, 2012, it will be the 99th birthday of the Federal Reserve. So, and interestingly, well, 99 years is the longest length that a business contract can last. You're supposed to renew it. There's, you know, 10-year contracts standard, 33-year contracts, and then 99-year contracts for creating a financial institution. So in my mind, I think it's quite possible that the 99-year contract on the Federal Reserve Bank is going to be up at that point. But at that point, you know, the whole thing may have been resolved, too, because, you know, I think that the next system is coming in quickly. So it could be that something important is going to happen on that date having to do with the banking system, but it may not be announced to us at that point either. You know, it may just, they may have it all tidied up before then already, you know?
No doubt about it. And
isn't there a bunch of debt too, junk bond debt, like billions, hundreds of billions that come due next year?
Oh, yeah.
Which is just going to, you know, start the ball rolling. It's going to start the cascading effect.
But what Tracy, what you said, and this is what I'm contending, I mean, we're $14 trillion in debt. I mean, forget what all the pundits say and all that. I hear all that stuff. I understand it. But sometimes, you know, they just go ahead and they act like it's a world, well, that doesn't really exist. I mean, when I look at this, and there's some others who aren't really voices well heard for obvious reasons, that are saying, and this is where I'm going too, we can't pay that back. And I think you touched upon it too. There's no way we're going to pay that back. Who's kidding? No. So what's the point if you're holding that Damocles sword over our head? Either we can go on like this ad infinitum, or you're going to let us go to a certain point and then call in whatever has to be called in, and that would be a global catastrophe, a tsunami, if you will, economically. How do you feel about that?
I feel that, you know, people who want to survive, who have some sort of survival instinct, you need to sort of snap out of it now and realize that there's no one in any position of power that has your best interests at heart. and participating in the system isn't going to help you. And I know, I'm not saying that, like, there's some easy solution. There isn't. No. But, you know, it's coming, the mask is coming off now. When you've got Obama saying, oh, gee, we might stop Social Security next month. I mean, hey, you know, that's, he's saying, oh, by the way, we've been, you know, writing fake checks or writing checks for the last few months. I mean, that's what that comes down to, because they've been collecting money for Social Security this whole time. They're supposedly putting it in a, you know, some special account. Well, obviously, they're not doing that. And so, you know, this shows you what you're in for. Are you going to be relieved if they raise the debt ceiling and they say, okay, you know, next month Social Security checks come out? Well, what does that tell you? It means that every time, you know, the bankers need more money, they're going to do that again to you, and it's just going to be endless. They're going to be constantly threatening to cut off your little benefits package, because that's, you know, they know that that's the only thing you've got now. And so, you know, I don't know how to start the rebellion here, but it needs to happen. People need to stop using the system and participating in it. And again, yeah, I have no solution, but I just know that there's no point in me, you know, sitting here telling you what I think the politicians should do or what the bankers should do or what we should do to try to make them do that, because the only thing we can do, you know, is try to become as self-sufficient as possible and try to get as far away personally as you can from the unfolding catastrophe. I don't know how you do that. You know, I guess we're all on our own, basically.
Well, I did this in 2002. I'm not saying this is the answer, because no matter what you do, as you said, in fact, you said you can't offer any solutions. There, in fact, may be no solutions. It's a question of getting hit less, I guess, hard than others do. But in 2002, I mean, my wife and I were great savers. We were mutual fund people and IRAs and 401. And we got beat up in, what, 87, around 94, 2001. And at that point, my wife and I had a come to Jesus meeting, and we said, what are we going to do? Are we going to keep our money in there? Because we're going to get ass kicked all the time. And I, you know, the mutual fund thing, which is what we were attracted to because we were good savers, but we kept going back. It was like a Sisyphus. How do I make that an adjective? I don't know.
Sisyphean.
There you go. And I mean, and you understand it. You roll the rock up, and damn, we're back. What? How many feet? And so what we did is we put everything into gold and silver. And I'm not saying that that's the best place to be. It's okay. But, I mean, I just had enough of this going on and being a sucker. A lot of people feel, and I have these discussions all the time, or exchanges in emails. Well, you know, they're afraid to pull the money out of the 401k. I understand it. But at least, and I'm not pitching anything right here, but even if you went into silver right now, which wants to jump like crazy, I mean, it's like $35 an ounce. It wants to go to $500 or $600 over time. But even if it didn't, you wouldn't take it in the chops like you do with your money in a 401k or these other instruments. My point is, if it isn't in your hands, it ain't in your hands. And that's one of the problems. People don't want to buck the system because they want to stay with what they feel is supposedly good, and yet it kicks them in the ass every 5 to 7 years. This is crazy.
Well, yeah, the frustrating thing for me when I hear people talk about that, you know, concerned about the fluctuating price of gold and silver versus the dollar, is that they obviously have not understood the concept. If you're investing in gold and silver, it's because you don't think the dollar is going to be there. So stop comparing it to the dollar. And that's really what people have to do. They have to stop thinking in terms of the existing system. Now, one of the things I like that's going on right now is Bitcoin, because, yes, it's not asset-based, but it's also not centralized. And I believe that the alchemy of fiat currency or ethereal imaginary money, I think that, you know, it can work. It is a way of doing business, and there's nothing wrong with it. And, in fact, I think that, you know, going back to a purely asset-based system would be problematic for a number of reasons. But I like Bitcoin because it is completely decentralized, and it's also resistant to inflation because it's they actually have a set amount of bitcoins that will be created over time.
Okay.
So, I don't have time to explain what it is exactly,
no, right.
But it's easy to spell BITCOIN. Look it up, and I think that's one of the up-and-coming waves of the future. It's an electronic currency that people invented that people can use without involving the government and without involving banks. And I think it's great.
You know, that's somewhat reminiscent. I had guests on several years ago, and this idea was not very popular because of the times weren't as bad. But with that reminds me of it also, and I'm not saying that this doesn't work, but they call the community currency. Have you ever heard of
right.
that?
No, sure. There's a whole bunch of them. Yeah.
I mean, that's a closed system, but like you said, it's closed because it's not involved in this whole thing, and that probably would work to a certain degree and probably work very well.
Yeah, we need competition, and we need more different ways of exchanging money, and we need decentralization, because that's the problem, is that you've basically got a handful of people running the entire global financial system. And even, Bernanke,
yeah.
recently basically just admitted he doesn't know what the hell's going on anymore. He's over his head. So, I mean, that's scary, you know. And that's the problem, is that whether they're doing it malevolently and Machiavellianly, you know, planning everything, or if it's, you know, really a case of, you know, these people are way in over their head. Either way, the problem is centralization. The problem is, you know, the power structure, you know. You have opted into a system where you're allowing other people to decide what's best for you, and they don't care about what's best for you. So that's the problem.
Before we cut you loose, I want to ask Andy if he has anything as far as a parting question or such, but you've said something a couple of times that reminds me. Are you familiar? It was floating around the YouTube for a while. I think it's finally gone. But did you ever see that priceless, like, 6-minute clip with George Carlin talking about this?
I don't know.
All right. If you haven't, if I can get you an email or something like that, let me send it up to you, because some of the things you've said are word for word what he was saying. Of course, he does it with his own little special affectation.
Right.
But it's the same thing coming down the line. And I had a laugh because whenever he was before whatever audience he was given a shtick, I mean, they were yahooing it up like crazy, but I don't really think that they understood that he was talking about them. that we all been hoodwinked. And they're like, yeah, yeah, no. And he goes, no, it's about you. They don't care about you. They don't care about you.
Oh, I know which one you're talking about.
Remember
yeah,
that
I,
one?
I've
yeah.
seen that before.
Because you said it a couple of times, and those buzzwords, I mean, I watch it every so often because I saved it. I'm like, yep, I couldn't have done it better. That was the history of the world in 7 minutes with Carlin. All right. Before you go, though, Andy, also, you have any parting questions or comments for Tracy?
We probably don't have time for questions, but what we usually do on this show and the other ones that we do actually too is look at the alchemy of the media and how certain stories, particularly paranormal ones, get blended in with political stories as a way of distracting. And they tend to really go up when you have banking problems, some corporation, Citibank or even big oil companies. When there's a problem, something embarrassing, you see a flurry of strange stories in the media to cover them up and distract. And we saw this just last, earlier this month with the, as they were doing this debt ceiling debate, which they blended for no reason with the tax rate hikes. You know, we can't have tax hikes on the rich, so we're going to have to cut Social Security, and somehow blame that on the debt ceiling. You know, this really spurious blending of concepts in the media that confuses everyone and just basically bamboozles them while, they push through something really terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And you saw a bunch of different crazy stories at the end of the month in June to go around that. And even that guy Strauss, who was the IMF banker, the IMF, right? The World Bank.
Yeah, that was so weird. Yeah, Dominique Strauss-Kahn getting accused of rape, and then and then sort of having his name cleared, but at that point he's already out of that position and someone else has taken over. And around the same time you had the IMF, their website was hacked, and the investigators said that they thought it was a state-sponsored hack. And I immediately just thought, you know, I thought of Ferris Bueller, if you remember how he hacked in to change his grade.
Yeah.
I thought that maybe the United States had done that, you know, to change their credit rating.
Yeah, well, they tried everything to distract from Strauss, and then the day he got let out, suddenly Gaddafi says he might attack Europe, supposedly.
Right.
They talked about a Mars colony. They'll often talk about some outer space thing. There was a big war games on the east coast of the U.S. At the same time. There was a white buffalo found the next day, you know, the Indian thing. UFOs over the BBC, that was that week. Fort Calhoun, you know, some scary thing that you have to really be worried about. So those things took away from from his story.
And remember another thing that captured everyone, and it's happened not too far from where I am right now, and that's the whole Casey Anthony situation.
Oh, yeah, that was... Yeah. Well, I don't know. I don't want to get into it, but it's like it's a bizarre obsession. And you know, I kind of didn't believe this woman when I interviewed her, and I kind of thought she was full of it. But some of the things she said have turned out, I don't know, interesting. Afterwards, I interviewed for my Mind Controlled Sex Slaves book, Kathy O'Brien.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And one of the things she said was that they like to name the girls that they turn into mind-controlled sex slaves after the goddess Kali, after the goddess of death in Jeez. The Hindu system. And so she said that there's a lot of missing girls named Kelly or Kaylee or Kylie or something like that. And, you know, I did that interview like 10 years ago, and I swear, like, since then there have been, like, hundreds of missing Kaylees. I don't know what it means, but...
Yeah, no doubt about it. In fact, they let her loose this morning. And, well, you know, I mean, to me, it's like, look, I understand what happened. The system has a hole in it, and it was exploited successfully. I just kind of rack my brain because it's like, okay, you got a two-year-old girl, and nobody's responsible. Nobody. And I'm like, okay, I think I got that. You know, and I tell you what, maybe you guys remember this. It was a line that I thought was stupid, three decades ago? And now all of a sudden it isn't in one of the Stone songs, and it says the mothers eat their daughters. So not a pleasant way to go off, but man alive. Hey, listen, Tracy, thanks for being with us. Andy, if you'll hang on, we'll close out. But Tracy,
yeah, I just
thanks
wanted to say, though, that the alchemy she's talking about, you know, dovetails nicely with the stuff that we're
absolutely
we normally talk about. So thanks for coming on, Tracy. It was really great.
Oh, sure, yeah, no problem. It was fun, and, you know, there's a zillion other topics we can talk about any old time. So
we'll hold you to that.
On.
Okay, thanks, Tracy.
All right. So long.
Bye-bye. You know, Andy, not to fixate on this, and I've seen a lot of opinion. There's a lot of emotion down here in Florida especially,